And now, Eric, I don't know if you've tried this or had experience before, but I'd like to try to see if I can get you set up with the Jupyter environment for Julia. This is like interactive notebook way of interacting with Julia that will be more familiar to Python people, certainly. But it involves a fair bit of setup. So I'm going to like fire that off, and then hopefully your like laptop's going to be like crunching away installing packages while I'm yakking away at the board. So if you want to go into Julia and then use the square bracket to go into the package manager, and then I think we want to go add, is it without spaces, I Julia? That's uppercase I Julia. Actually not totally sure of that. I am I am also new to Julia, so yeah, okay. That's at least syntactically correct. Okay.
Does it matter whether we're in some subdirectory or another?
For adding a package, I don't think so. It's funny, my laptop is closed, but the screen is still on. I'm just going to unplug that. Okay, so I wanted to start with a couple of comments from last time. Partly because Gifre asked a really good question that I gave the wrong answer to, so I'm going to at least correct that. Okay, so last time we were looking at, we were writing down likelihoods for our observations. So we wrote this down as...
Dustin, can you switch to, can you change the light to...
Oh yeah, sure. So I go lecture. Lecture mode, is that better? Yeah, okay. Okay, so, right, we had this plot. Where this axis really ought to be called y. And we had a couple of observations. So we had, I kind of arbitrarily set them to be like 5, 6, and 8 were happened to be our observations. And this one is the probability for this, what was our second data point for different values of y, right? Which you mean, and then we found, so we had other observations, we had 3 observations in total, and we then computed the likelihood for getting those 3, which was a product of the individual likelihoods. And it turned out that these individual likelihoods that are Gaussian is also a Gaussian. And that looked like this. So you might write this as the probability of getting this set of observations for some real value of y. And we found that it peaked at some intermediate value. That we called y hat, and we could constrain it with some uncertainty that we called y hat, or a signal y hat. And then finally, we used Bayes' rule to turn that likelihood into an actual statement about our belief in the real value of y based on those observations. Okay, so there's a couple of comments to make about that. One is it might be sort of funny to think about using the language of probabilities for talking about why, because that's a real quantity that exists in the world, right? That was like the true position of this star that we were measuring. So why? How can we talk about like probabilities for a thing that just like has an actual value? So in Bayesian statistics, we use the like mechanics of probabilities, but it's really kind of representing our beliefs or our knowledge or our uncertainty. About that quantity, it's basically summarizing what we can say about what we believe of the value of Y to be. So it's like this thing is basically what we can claim about the value of Y, given the facts we have in the world. And then the great thing is that Bayes' rule gives you the mathematics for updating your statement about what you believe, given new observations. So imagine that I publish my paper that has these values for y hat and sigma hat. This was 6 1/3, and this was 1/√3. And you want to then take some follow-up observations. You'd like to measure that value more precisely, right? So you go out and take a new observation called y new, and then you'd like to be able to write in your paper an update on what we believe about y given this new observation. And I'm going to leave a little bit of space here for myself. So last time we wrote this as a likelihood term. Myself the space, a prior term, and an evidence term that we kind of swept under the rug. Not a set, it's just one observation. And the thing that's sort of implicit is that also given is sort of everything else about the world that you already know. So you could think about writing this as E for like everything else about the world. So that includes, for us, last time, E included things like the values of the sigma i's. We just treated those as like facts or givens. We didn't have any uncertainty in them. So mathematically, you can just add the e's on the right hand of all of the equations, and the math works fine. And in particular, for this one, you can include my previous measurement as your prior information before you started your experiment. Remember last time we said, this prior is sort of what you're willing to believe about why before you've seen any data. So before you took your new observation, you might or might not choose to believe my published value for why. So if you choose to include my measurement of why, then you get that your new statement about how why is constrained, I'm going to drop the E again, is proportional to the likelihood for your new data point times the distribution that I published. So the probability distribution that I published, which it turned out was this Gaussian that had value y hat and sigma hat squared. And the So remember, this was basically a summarization or product of those three likelihoods of my single observations. And then basically yours just gets multiplied in. So it's as though your observation is included in the original analysis. It's pretty neat. And so basically this lets you kind of update your beliefs or your statement of what you quantitatively know about the world. So that's kind of where the the magic of this lies. And it's not very impressive to be able to add one new data point to three new data points, but often in cosmology, this will be like the results of the Planck experiment. So you can summarize like billions of euros worth of experimental results in a new analysis.
So are you saying that if I make a new experiment just with one data point, that they really will consider that data point as important as any of the previous ones? So in this case,
yeah. So imagine you go out and measure, I measured some y hat that was like this. This is my Gaussian of y hat and sigma hat squared. You go out and measure this value. The product of these two things is going to be like, probably like something like this, right? Your new measurement could move this by, basically an arbitrary amount. If indeed, the assumptions hold that you're measuring the same true quantity and you've stated your error bars correctly, then yeah, for sure. It's basically the power. It says new observations are kind of equivalent to. There's nothing special about an observation that was taken in the past. It's, you can just add new information to it. One catch about this is that this value I published had my priors baked into it. Right? I put a prior on the values y based on nothing. Based on, I just said it was flat. So if you pull that into your analysis, you also pick up that assumption. And especially, if this is, instead of my three observations, if this is Planck, that's got a lot of stuff baked into it. And it can be hard to keep track of what things have been assumed. There was a question.
So if you add new information, does it change the true value?
Well, does it change the true value? The true value is something that exists in the universe. What it changes is what we're willing to say about our belief in the value based on the observations we've taken. This is like the values that I were consistent, and it's possible that we got unlucky and these measurements that we took were out on the tails of being fairly unlikely. That, in other words, if we repeated the same experiment a lot of times, we would very rarely get that value. Basically, that's our like fair statement of what we can conclude about why based on what we observed. okay, I want to draw one more plot with this data set, which is, I maybe should have started with this one. I'm going to draw it here. Which is, imagine you really know imagine you really know the true value of Y, like, I don't know, the LHC has measured it to 10 decimal places. Then you can plot something that's slightly different, which is the likelihood of your data, given that Y has this value of 7, say, and that you had the uncertainties that you, as before. Now, here's the true value. Here's what how your measurements would be distributed. So if you went out on 1,000 nights and took a bunch of measurements, they would be distributed as a histogram that looked like that. And the three measurements that we happened to get were here. So basically, we drew three samples from that distribution. How you can think of it. And that's why I was nervous about how to label this axis. So that ought to be labeled yi now. Right? That's like if you nail down a true value for y, these are the values of your observations you should expect to find. And when you take a measurement, you get a sample from it, and all you have is the observation. You don't know whether it was a sample that was at the peak of the distribution or out on the tails. And you know, you sort of if I took three observations, I would be very surprised to get an observation that was way out on the tails, but it could happen. Okay. I think I've belabored that more than enough. Any additional questions about yesterday? All right. Okay. So today we're going to move on to an exciting new world. It's going to look very much like the last world. And again, I scanned my notes from yesterday and put them on the course webpage. I'll do the same today. They came out a little smudgy because the actual original is smudgy as well, and the scanner did something funny with it. But it's still, I think, about as legible as it actually gets. I also, by the way, put up a notebook with kind of my working through the lab's stuff for today. So if you get stuck or you want a little cheat sheet or you want to look at what the plots might look like, you can use that if you want. It'd probably be more instructive to try to work through it on your own before looking at the kind of answer sheet, but it's there. Okay, so today we're going to do fitting a straight line. So much fun. And you know, you'll laugh, but this is, you can either call it fitting a straight line, or linear regression, or statistical inference, or machine learning, or data science. It's like 80% of data science. So, you know, if you so we're going to do a data set that looks pretty similar. Gonna make things a little more interesting by giving different uncertainties on the data. And so if we plot these guys up, they're they go something like, what, a little low. So, you know, it's roughly I'm approximating, but it's a sort of data set that just makes you want to slam a line through it. So that is what we're going to do. We're going to use, like similar to yesterday, I'm going to force us to sort of go through all of the assumptions and setup of how we're going to do the analysis. So I'm going to use this model. Know and love of y equals mx plus b. So we're going to state this assumption that that rarely goes stated, that the uncertainties on x are negligible or zero, basically. So like x is just given, like say it's, so in practice, there are very few things in experimental physics that are actually really known, but some things are a lot easier to measure than others. So precise timekeeping is a lot easier than measuring the positions of stars to, you know, a couple of digits of accuracy. So, you know, if my experiment is I go out at the same time each night and take an observation and measure the position, this might be the time might be good to, you know, 4 digits of accuracy or whatever, whereas the position is good to like 1 digit of accuracy. So for all intents and purposes, the error bars in this direction are tiny, and we're going to just ignore them outright today. If you're in a case where that doesn't hold, then things get a lot more interesting. And you should definitely not do this model because it doesn't treat those uncertainties. Okay, so as before, we're going to say that our measurements are this true y value plus some additive error term that, and we're going to make the usual assumption that the errors are IID, independently and identically distributed, and drawn from the Gaussian with zero mean and this varying sigma squared. Okay, so questions on that? I swear we're going to get to the actual lab stuff in a minute. Okay, so like before, we can write the uncertainties for our observations given parameters. So now our parameters are m and b. These are the parameters of our model for the data. Since they're IID, the probability of the set of them is just the product of the individual ones. And as before, there's this term with the square root of 2 pi sigma, and then the exponential term has the minus a half. I'm going to do it the other way around. X plus b minus y squared, sigma I squared I, and that's y I. And this is the likelihood we know and love. And so we could go through the whole procedure we did yesterday of writing down the log likelihood, taking the derivatives, setting them to zero, find the maximum likelihood, m's and b's. But today I'm going to take a slightly different step. So I'm going to still write down the log likelihood. So we have the constant that comes from those terms. And minus half the sum of this chi-squared term. Okay. And let's see, some board space. All right. So this chi squared term can, let's see, we can write as a matrix equation. So we can write it, if we pull out this a vector y that has y1, y2, dot, dot, dot. There is a sort of awkward change of convention in that I'm going to call this thing A that has the values 1 and x1, 1 and x2, and so on. And then the value of x is going to have B and M. And then there's finally a weight matrix, W has 1 over sigma 1 squared, 1 over sigma 2 squared, and so on, diagonal. So now you can write that chi squared is, don't mess this up, AX minus Y transpose times W times AX minus Y. I should have written that on a board that I could move up. Reach the back of the board so that's nailed down. And let's see. A bit more space. And it turns out that we can, this is just a matrix least squares problem. So this is we're trying to minimize chi squared. So we're trying to minimize a least squares problem. And that is just linear algebra is all over that problem. So Julia has a built-in operator to solve problems like that. And it doesn't even have, well, so far as I know, it only has the name backslash. It doesn't even have like any other name. And it's actually kind of hard to find in the documentation because it's just like baked in. So we're going to use that. Okay. I messed up my boards here. I'm going to use this to find this best fitting x hat. And in order to use this least squares fitting, we're going to have to take the square root of the w and put it on either side. So we're going to end up doing solving this slash y like that. And that's going to be the best fitting values for this intercept and slope of the line. And then also from linear algebra, we can get out covariances on those best fits. And that turns out to be that value. I'm just going to leave that there. for your cheat sheet once we start the lab. Okay, so finally, the things we're going to try to do today. I'm going to write them here so that we can kind of,
So I understand X hat the result of doing something with it.
Uh-huh.
But covariant matrix, is that just there's no, it's a deterministic multiplication of A and W? A and W are provided from the variant hat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. So it's like it's not affected by the data. And that's actually true of the sigma hat that we came up with yesterday. It actually also doesn't depend on the data. So weirdly enough, you know, sort of regardless of how far apart your data points might be, your uncertainty in their mean is just fixed basically by how many of them and how precise they are. Okay, so I'd like us to try today to set up this matrix equation. With that data set. And try solving it with and without, including the W matrix. So try solving like a version where you treat all of the uncertainties the same, or where you make some of them less certain than others. Try plotting the data points with their error bars. And the best fit weighted and unweighted lines. Compute that covariance. So that's basically the covariance between your, like basically how well constrained the M and B values are by the data. And then make some plots in this MB plane. So the best fits. And a sampling of values from the covariance. I should actually show what kind of plots I'm talking about here. But you can, if you look in the... pardon?
Yeah.
I'm going too low?
Yeah.
Good point. I'm almost done. actually, no. Okay, so let me. And then plot in XY space your data best fit and sampling of lines that are consistent with the covariance, so drawn from that covariance matrix. And then kind of optionally also fit a quadratic and plot it. Okay, so let me kind of say the plots I'm imagining here. So basically, I'd like to take our X observations, Y, we have these values like that. And it didn't, it's a terrible plot. So if you ignore the, so the best fit, you know, should be something that looks like a best fit. If you use the weights, you should find that the line kind of wants to, is drawn more closely to going through these two data points and is a little bit more floppy on the less well-measured data points. And then if you, so then in the M and B plane, there should be some best fit for using the weights and some other best fit value if you ignore the weights. And then there's some covariance matrix between them. So, and it turns out they're anti-correlated because you can basically, if you shift the intercept up, you have to bring the slope down. And so there's a little bit of floppiness between them. So if you draw a bunch of samples from that covariance matrix, you should get that they sort of lie along some, you know, banana like that. And if you plot them on top of here, you should see that they're basically like a set of lines that are kind of consistent with the data points, but explore the kind of range that they're allowed to have. Okay, so that's that part. So actually, why don't we just start with, I won't write anything further, but after that, we're going to write down the log likelihood function and then start kind of playing with that. So this first part is basically exploring the linear algebra view of linear regression. And then we'll sort of flip over to the probabilistic, like more statistically view of the same problem. See how it differs. It's the same. Sound good? Okay. So I'm not exactly sure how we should actually like do this. I was thinking I could basically start up a Julia notebook and start typing, and then you can watch how bad I am at the language, and you can either follow along if you want or not, and I'll stop occasionally and like go around and answer questions and stuff. Okay, so if your installation of iJulia worked, then from a terminal or whatever, if you type Jupyter-notebook, magic should happen. So that's back at a normal like terminal or whatever. And it's Jupyter-notebook. Pardon?
Do you have to type using
iJulia first? Oh, that's a... yeah, probably. So I guess you can like, you can do it from the Julia prompt, right? You can... so what, part of the reason I don't really know this is that I already had Jupyter notebooks installed on the Python side, so... And it seemed to just kind of pick up Julia somehow magically that I don't understand. So I think that if you go to Julia and you go using iJulia, and then is it like notebook? Yeah, notebook is a function. How about if we call a function? Yeah, okay, so that should do basically the same thing. starts up a Jupyter notebook, and with luck, yeah, okay, good. Anybody have problems with that? Anybody have it working?
Yeah,
and using my Julia, and then you go notebook. Okay, and then let's put me in some weird directory. Oh, because I started it from some weird directory. So I'm instead going to go into my computational physics directory, restart Julia, go using iJulia, and then notebook. So that should start up this notebook server and then bring me over to the web browser. Still in any directory, the prompt is, and then go new Julia notebook. Call it lab one. Live. Okay, I'm just gonna take a little like look around and see how people are doing. Having any luck? Okay, cool. You've got your notebooks going. Cool, right on. All right, big empty screen. All right, looks like people are like in good shape. Awesome. I thought that was going to be like a bit of a gong show to actually get that running. Now, the question is, how much do I want to cheat? I guess I'm going to not cheat very much. Type in our data set like some kind of animal. I'll use X. And I'm putting dots here because I want to make them floating point. I feel just sort of suspicious or like superstitious about that. Okay, we'll see if I remember how to make plots. Using plots. It's taking a while to make the plot. I assume it's like compiling something or another. Okay, good. That is not a very nice looking plot. There's some thing that says that I want it to be a scatter plot. I'm going to cheat and look at what its series type equals scatter. Okay. Colon scatter. Good, so that makes dots, and I don't want a legend right now. Okay, and I want y error bars are given by sigma. Good, so there's my data set.
Can you show the previous?
Oh, yeah, sure. And you might want to, instead of trying to follow on along directly, you might want to like grab my cheat sheet. Just test. But sure.
Nice.
Okay, what time is it? Oh, perfect. Okay, good. All right, so I'm going to start building the matrices. Let's see. So there's the big Y is just little y because Julia. And A, I'm going to make, oh yeah, right. I want N to be the length of Y. That's just going to be 4. And then I'm going to start with an A matrix that is N by 2. Right, and then I'm going to set the colon for all the rows. The first column to be 1. Yeah, that doesn't work. Turns out you have to go dot equals. Because you're like taking a scalar value and like broadcasting it. Works in Python, I'm saying. I'm going to make that X, maybe. And then, yeah, so then this. So now this A matrix has the form I want, where it has ones here and the X values here. So it's got, you know, that form. And then you make W be this function called diagonal, I think. Gotta cheat. Oh yeah, that's right, I remember. Have to use linear algebra. And then there's a function called diagonal, where you can put in the sigmas. I want to do it element by element, so that like that. Ha, there we go. Bunch of dots in the right place to get the W matrix right. Matrices. Oh yeah, that's right. I don't know X yet. I want to find. Now, whoops. If I do square root W, does that just work? Looks like it does. Okay, so the thing I want to compute is square root of W times A. And then I want to backslash that by square root of W times Y. And I don't know what the parens do, so I'm just going to add more. Okay, so this is my weighted values of M and B. And for kicks, I'm going to compute the unweighted version. Okay, so now I'm going to try to plot the data and the best fit lines. And if you go plot exclamation point, it will add to your plot. And I can go MB times A. Nope. Here we go. Go A times MB. Okay, there's my best fit line. Small in that little thing. And then there's something about I can make the line a different color. a different health and a different width. Yeah, so I'm going to make a thick, make it blue. And then I'm also going to plot the unweighted best bit. And we'll look at that for a second. Add a label to this. Label equals data. And I turned off the legend, so I'll turn that back on. But I want to put the legend over in the top left. Okay, so there's roughly this first plot. Does anybody know how to set the legend text and the axis text? They're just ridiculously tiny. There must be something in the manual about how to do that, but it seems like there should be some reasonable way of making a default.
So label equals, that was for the axis, label by label. The other one?
Yeah, so I can go x label equals night, I guess,
and the other
y label.
Each plot you can put just label.
But it's still,
but
the font size is still tiny. I can't even see it. So there must be something in the. So I guess I can look in Julia plots attributes, maybe. There must be something on here about the font. That didn't work. Julia plot font. Changing the overall font size. Yeah, that's what I want. Oh no, it's an issue. But it's a closed issue. That might be good.
Oh, for the
Yes.
Scale font size. That didn't work at all. I don't know what that did, but that's that.
Oh, you're using a different browser. Maybe it works in a different browser. Because your legend window increased as if the font size increased, but the actual font size didn't.
Okay.
I'm using Safari and I'm not having the problem you're seeing, so maybe, okay, let's switch to Chrome, sure.
Password or token?
It seems to be working in Chrome and Safari, but
it's Chrome.
How do I get my token?
Actually, I emailed, I just stopped appearing.
Do you know how I get the...
Because I didn't get through this, I saw it in the Windows program, so I
should have your notebook list.
I just don't know what your copy is.
Whatever I did to the... Well, sort of. Whatever I did to... I asked for big fonts in my plots, and I guess I got what I asked for.
Restart the kernel.
What's that?
Restart the kernel. F not defined.
What?
I guess I... Okay. So I have to restart my kernel. Okay, so then I'm gonna go on and compute this covariance matrix. So let's see, it's A transpose, so that's A quote in Julia times W times A. The inverse of that whole thing. And then that's the covariance, but I want to draw some sets.
The window?
Oh, yeah, of course, sure. It's my, maybe, like that, right?
Thank you.
Is that better? Because I'd like to be able to plot, I'd like to look at how the M and B parameters change. And so it's that, if I waited ones, double quotes. Okay. What is it? Series type will scatter. And there we go. Okay, and now I'd like to add to that plot some samples from that covariance matrix of how well constrained those M and B parameters are. But I only have a covariance, so I need like just the variance of it, which I can get from square root of C, I think. And I'm just going to draw some random samples, maybe like 10. And if I take that and multiply it by square root of C, nope, other way around. Should get some values that are distributed according to that covariance matrix, I think. So if I then go boom, so let's call that EMB. What's that? Then I'm going to grab the plot. That value plus the first element in that array. And the second in that, I should get a sampling. Oh no, I've got it backwards. I need all the rows and the first column. I've only plotted one data point. All the rows and the column. And I should get like 10 data points. Now, I'll make it 100 for kicks. And there's my sampling of M's and B's that are consistent with the uncertainties that we have, the fit. So that's kind of a nice way of like, instead of plotting like contours, it's easier. But let's plot contours too. Let's see if I can do a contour plot. It's not a nice contour plot. There. So of course it's fun to make the banana plots, because I'm a cosmologist. Life is all about like plotting uncertainty contours on parameters that we kind of don't actually care about. But to get a feeling for how well your data analysis is going, it's really fun to go back into the data space and show what those different parameter values actually look like. And so let's do that for a second. So I'm going to grab the plot again. I'm going to drop the unweighted one. Who would do that? What? Oh, I messed it up. I renamed my variable x. So I'm going to go and redefine that. Okay. All right, so what we can do is go for I in the range of 1 to 10, take one of the random samples. So we had these ones, right, the DMBs. I'm going to add those. I want one row and all columns. And then I'm going to fit that line in, or plot that line instead. I'm going to go. And I'm going to make it in a kind of faint black with no label. And that does nothing. I don't know why. And I hit this before, and I don't know what it's, why it doesn't plot anything. I'm gonna flip over to my other, my cheat sheet, and see if I remember what I did. Weighted and unweighted. Yeah. Anybody knows why that works? Be happy to hear it. I have like no idea why, what that is or what it's doing, but it looks like when I tried to add a bunch of plots to lines to the plot inside of a loop, it doesn't show them. And then outside of the loop, if you do that magic, it does. There you go. I'm going to make them a little darker for the display. On the screen, it looks pretty good. And I'm going to plot like 25 of them, maybe. Actually, if we plot 25, it should show up a little better. Yeah, that's kind of nice. So I love this sort of plot where it's like, you know, you show your best fit value, then you also show a bunch of other fits that are consistent with the data. And since these are they're random samples drawn according to the covariance, they are really like basically like fair draws from this distribution of lines that you would say would fit these data points. So it's a pretty nice way of visualizing kind of how well your data constrain your model. It can be really handy for just kind of getting a feeling for what the model space looks like and what the covariances look like. So in this example, the uncertainties on the two pairs of data were pretty similar. Just for kicks, I'm going to go back and shrink down the data points on the first two points, and then we'll kind of see how visually what that does after the results. Actually, I'm going to do that in a do it as another copy of it. I'll make it W2. And I'm going to make it sigma 2. Let's make them half as big. And then I'll have to redo all of the bits. What else we need? Things to twos. That's not right. It's like I made something imaginary. All right, that wasn't what I was expecting.
Can you show the values?
Yeah, let's do that. So MB2 looks fine. I'm gonna guess it's that the covariance does something funny. Because we're taking the square root. Yeah, so for some.
Huh. There's your negative numbers in your variance.
Yeah, that's okay though. Things are allowed to be anti. But it looks like, for whatever reason, maybe it's close to singular or something. It's got imaginary components.
But like, there's zero in the imaginary.
Yeah. That's the weird part.
Can you just select the number?
Can we look at the, so yeah, it looks like the imaginary part of C2 is, so I'm sure this is a feature. and as long as I can turn it off, it's still a feature. So I guess I want the real part. That matrix, right? Yeah, okay. There we go. So I'm going to make these even smaller and see what we get. Similar result. Okay, so that's kind of fun, actually. I'm going to like scroll up and look at this one. And you can see how, you know, basically all of these data points, all of these bits kind of want to hit this data point on the high side. And they all more or less thread that one. And then they all kind of hit that one on the high side. Now, when I crank down the errors on the leftmost two ones, basically the fits all really want to thread through those two data points because the uncertainties are pretty small. You know, we're pretty constrained to thread through those. And then, as it turns out, it hits that one more or less. And it kind of ignores that one. Well, there's a 2.5 sigma tension with that data set, which is you know, very exciting if that's your experiment and it costs you $100 million. Dollars that time? Not euros?
You said euros earlier.
Yeah, well, Planck is a European mission. It weighs in euros. Okay, right. So I think I'll skip the quadratic plot. It's in the answer key notebook, and move on to the, what's time, 2:30, perfect. Move on to the probabilistic view. So basically, it's kind of funny because when you start working in this way, the first thing you end up writing most of the time is basically a log likelihood function. So I'm going to start writing our log likelihood for a line, and it's going to take our measurements x, y, sigma, m, and b. So it's kind of a mixture of data and parameters. And I'm going to skip I'm just going to return the chi-squared part, so, or the minus a half chi-squared part, so it's a sum over a thing squared, so it's y minus m times x plus b, that thing squared over sigma squared. Okay, so now if I call it with our data set, and I'm going to use the best fit. Oh, I'm going to use the best fit values that we computed above. Those were called MB. So I'm going to go M best, B best. Didn't work, and I think it's because, I think it's because some of these things are vectors and some are not, so we have to do a whole bunch of dots, a dot everywhere, and then it will treat them all as scalars and do those things element-wise. Now, I think Julia has some magic for avoiding having to write all the dots everywhere that I am not that familiar with. There's some like magic decorator thing, right? You can go like at dot, anybody? Try that, see if it works. Hoping Eric would answer that. Oh, yeah, that didn't work at all. It didn't, what did it do? It didn't sum over.
Yeah,
it didn't do the sum. Okay, because I think maybe we want the dot in there. Yeah, okay, so there's this like magical, very like cryptic looking at dot kind of, maybe it's called a decorator. And it just says everything within that brackets do element wise. So do the way Python or NumPy would do it, like element by element. So it sort of adds, it seems to add dots to all of the operators. So it makes it a little bit easier to write. Okay, so this is so that's giving us a log likelihood for a single m and b value, but it's a little bit awkward to have to pass those x, y, and sigma all the time, right? So we'd like to wrap that function in an easier to call function that takes just the m and b parameters. So you can do that. So I'm just going to call this one line LNL for log likelihood. And I'm going to switch it around so that instead of taking two scalars, it takes a vector. Do I want that? No, I'll still make it. Okay, and then here's the funny thing. you can, within a function, you can return a function as a return value. So maybe I'll just write how this is going to go. So this one is going to call the full one with x, y, sigma, and the m and b that were passed in. Oh, no, wait. I did it wrong. I'm messing it up. Actually, I can just go like this. I can go return. Oh yeah, that's right. Okay, I can do that. Right, there is another step I want to do though. Okay, so now I can go find log likelihood with b best and m best. Okay, same value as before. But the thing is, I would like to also be able to do this on another data set at the same time. So maybe I'd like to be able to analyze, you know, the data set with the smaller error bars at the same time. So I'd like to be able to like not have these values baked in, but be able to bake in values of like data vectors of my own. So before I do that, let's look at this for a second. This is really weird because it's a function that takes two parameters, but then it also reaches out into the global environment and uses those x and y and sigma that were like defined outside of that function, which is like a slightly dangerous thing to do, especially since, you know, if I go and redefine x at this point, then bad things could happen. So I'm going to try to write this in a way that doesn't kind of reach out into the global scope. And I did manage to do it before, so hopefully I can remember how to do it without cheating on my notes. Okay, and here's how it goes. So we're going to make a function that returns a function. Which will seem like a bizarre thing to do. But I hope when it's done, you'll see what the point is. Okay, so this one, we're going to make it so that you do have to pass in the data you want. And it is not going to take parameters. And it's going to return a function that takes an m and a b. And that function returns find log likelihood of x, y, sigma, m, and b. And just for kicks, I'm going to switch those around.
I think you misspelled likely.
Oh yeah, likely hook. and then I'm going to return that f as the return value of that function. Okay, so whoa. Does it work? Okay, it does work. Good. All right, so this is another weird looking function. So we're passing in x, y, and sigma. And within that scope, finding a function that reaches out, but now it reaches out to this scope and knows about those values, and then also knows about the two values that you pass in. So it's weird. and I don't know. I don't know what. So the result of that basically is that this thing is a function that you can call that has bound within that function the variables x, y, and sigma. Now.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not understanding what you're saying. So. What's the goal? What are we trying to accomplish?
Yeah, what's the goal is that so that we could make, so that we could have two different data sets that we're dealing with without, okay, so say, for example, if I wanted to analyze, to use, like, to experiment with using different sigmas, I could make a function like that, that that has different variable, that has different data bound to it.
What's sigma 2
there? Oh yeah, sorry. So sigma 2 was where I said, oh, what happens if I make the variances on the first two data points much smaller? Like, what if my first two data points are way better measurements than the others? So this trick lets you basically build two functions that know about different data sets. And they look like they're functions that just take two arguments, but they know about different data sets.
So another option would have been to write two different functions?
Yeah, that's right. So you could write, yeah, exactly. So you could also write it as like,
the line log likelihoods and you would be applied to.
Yeah, that's right. So you could write, you could also write like line log likelihood 2 that uses sigma 2 like that, and then you call it like, then you could use it like this. Yeah, so yeah, that's totally right. Now, a question that I don't know the answer to is what happens in all of these cases if you now change the values of x, y, or sigma? I'm a little bit scared to find out. But I think that's a good reason to find out. So currently x is just this value 1, 2, 3, 4. What if we set the first value to be 4 again? Do we get the same value? We don't. That's not ideal. I wonder if we can make a copy. Copy, is that a function?
What is deep copy?
I think it's supposed to make a full copy of the array. So like allocate new memory and make a new copy of the array. Instead of, sometimes if you just, if you say like, z equals x, then it'll point to, it'll actually point to the same, like the same bit of memory, same copy of the array. So if you make a change to z, it would also show up in x. But if you make z a deep copy of x, maybe there's just a copy. Then you can change z and it won't change x. Yep, so now z, the first element that is changed, and but the first element in x is still the same. Yeah. Okay. This kind of got derailed. But let's push on anyway. all that stuff. Okay. Okay, so we have a log likelihood function. We can now evaluate that on a bunch of, on any like M and B that we like, and map out what this likelihood space looks like. So I'm going to do that for by just creating a grid of M and B values and calling our log likelihood for each one. So we're going to find that, you know, this has very low likelihood and this has also very low likelihood and so on. And that'll give us a map, like a 2D surface of what that likelihood space looks like. And the peak of it is going to correspond to the peak that we found before, because we're still working with the same data. But having written out these functions, we're going to be in a really good place to do other things with them. Okay, so I'm going to make these arrays MM. I want to make them have good values. So I'm going to look at what the covariance matrix was. We don't have that anymore. It's C. So the variances on those two things were, I'm just going to grab them and make a range from the best M value minus 3 sigma up to plus 3 sigma in 100 steps. So I'm going to make a grid of 100 points. So if I look at what those values are, it's going to be like that set of numbers. I'm going to do the same thing for B. Now, did we put B first or second in the arrays? B first. So that's that. Okay. All right, so now I'm going to make this array of log likelihoods initially going to be zeros or that match the shape of these two things. I'm going to go for I in one length of MM, or J in length of B, and then going to call our let's just do this one. For those particular values, I'm going to go MMI. Okay. Okay. And. And then do I have plot? No, I have plots already.
Geez, it looks equal to LL.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Thank you. So that was fast. That was running 10,000 copies of that. And there, we can make this lovely heat map of this parameter space. So this is, again, it's actually probably the other way around. B, M. And so that's basically just, you know, mapping out that if you have a value that's in the middle, it will have a high like log likelihood, and as you move away from that, it gets sort of lower and lower log likelihood. and it's in these funny units of that go from like minus 10 to minus 80, so those are like chi-squared values, basically. Okay, good, excellent. And the these values are not really useful because I basically just gridded up this space, and this is telling me how many elements I put in my grid rather than anything useful about M of B. I don't know how to make heat map do the right thing, like how to tell it what the range, what the like extent of the image is. So I'm just going to not do anything about that right now. And I think we're close enough to three that I can kind of call it there. And we'll like do more questions and stuff. Thanks. So what's coming up next, I'll just say, is I'm going to deal with the problem of outliers and how to deal with them. And so I'm going to imagine that, you know, on night five, you get this observation. And then on night six, you get this observation. So you think, oh, what happened? And it turns out that that's not actually very easy to deal with in these like linear algebra or very traditional sorts of ways. If you're in astronomy, you just say, clearly that's an outlier, we'll just drop it from our analysis. Or you do like sigma clipping, that is basically the same thing. But since we're in likelihood space and we can think about statistical models for our data, we're going to deal with this by saying, by changing our statistical model so that instead of there being just a likelihood around the true value, we're going to say there's that, plus there's just some possibility that I messed up, or that there was some artifact in the detector or something like that. So it's going to be this plus like some broad distribution. It's allowed to take many values. It's allowed to take large values. And this is going to be constrained by the position of this one is going to be constrained by our model parameters, and this one's just going to be allowed to float. And every data point is basically going to get to choose whether it came, which distribution it came from. Did you come from, are you a real observation of the phenomenon, or are you like an observation of the artifact generating process? So it's pretty neat that you can do that in this framework. And it's going to turn out to not take very much effort to do that. So it's fun. And really like, we'll take you beyond kind of standard practice. So it'll be good and exciting and fun, I hope, for like a statistician's idea of fun.